Home Rule and Iguanas. A Monroe County lawmaker discusses her new role in the County Commission. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Holly Rashine spent 8 years representing Monroe County in Tallahassee. Now she's doing it from the County Commission. She shared with us why she wants more money for land protection, her desire to eradicate iguanas, and the issue of home rule. Also, the Miami Book Fair is coming back, almost fully back, to pre-pandemic days. We'll give you a preview. And finally,
if science were just more of a process, taught as a journey rather than as a destination, I think our attitudes towards it would just be completely different coming out the other side.
Neil deGrasse Tyson has a few ideas on how we should be teaching science, and he'll share them with us. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The Florida Keys need money, just like the Everglades. Also, there's a big problem with iguanas down there. These are two big issues for Monroe County Commissioner Holly Rashine. Now, she replaced Mike Forster, who died of complications from COVID-19 last year. Governor Ron DeSantis appointed the former Republican state representative back in September. Rashine is supporting a Senate bill that would secure more annual funding for the Florida Keys, and we spoke with Commissioner Rashine about all of that and some of the state's efforts to preempt local governments on certain issues earlier today. What's it like on the other side, if that's fair to say, because it's the local side of lawmaking now, and you know, you spent 8 years in the state legislature.
Yes, and it has been, it's been bittersweet. It's been challenging sort of switching my brain from the state of Florida to Monroe County. Mike Forster, Commissioner Mike Forster, was such a good friend and such an amazing public servant. So filling his shoes is going to be a quest, but a quest that I'm willing to step up to the plate and do. And again, you know, I just can't underscore enough his incredible public service, his willingness to come to bat for our community. And so I just wanted to get that out there in the universe and thank Governor DeSantis and his team for, you know, deeming me a good replacement for Mike.
And you talked about Commissioner Forster's legacy and carrying that on. What for you, what does that mean?
Sure. Well, we were of like minds and many, many things. The environment, obviously, being the top one, cleaning up our nearshore waters, making sure that our coral reefs are preserved. You know, they're under attack right now. Workforce housing has always been a challenge and will continue to be a challenge here in the Florida Keys. But, you know, we've worked hard to move the needle. And that's something that Mike was passionate about. And that's something that I'm equally passionate about. And, you know, traffic seems to be the topic of the day down here. You know, we have one highway. It's the lifeblood of our community. And technically, it wasn't designed for as many people and motorists, visitors and residents alike. And so finding some incremental changes that will help alleviate some of that congestion and the issues that we see, especially on the weekends and during holidays. These were something that that Mike was passionate about, again, me too. And then, you know, our community is incredible. We have so many resources at our fingertips. And I think, you know, really drilling down and you know, how can we sort of make this government move even more smoothly and more transparently. That's something that's a big deal, having, you know, spent most of my career in government.
All right. There's a few things that you mentioned, and I want to tackle these. Let's start with the environment. And I want to start with Senate Bill 602. And it wants to see a guaranteed annual amount of money that's implemented to the Florida Keys Stewardship Act. You helped pass that in 2016, right?
Yeah, actually, that was my crowning achievement in the legislature. That was my number one priority. And I was able to get that passed, you know, about halfway through my term in office. And I couldn't be more proud to see the efforts by my successor, you know, Representative Jim Mooney and our state senator, Ana Maria Rodriguez, in pushing this effort through. So if you want me to, I can just explain real quick what the Stewardship Act actually does.
Yeah, briefly. Go ahead, please. Yes.
Sure. So the Stewardship Act, the Florida Key Stewardship Act, sets up a process by which two important factors in our community are funded by the state. That's land acquisition. So basically taking units or lots or parcels off the tax rolls for in perpetuity. These are parcels that shouldn't be built on. They shouldn't be developed. They're very environmentally sensitive and they need to be preserved and conserved for generations. And so that's the land acquisition component. The larger component and equally important though, is the water and the water protection part of the legislation. So it dedicates funding towards canal restoration, not really wastewater. We're done with that. Stormwater. People always forget what a big, you know, polluter stormwater is. Coral restoration. I mean, all these good things that go into our environment and our water resources, which is the backbone of not only the Florida Keys but South Florida and Florida as a state.
And so I'm
excited.
SB 602. Guarantees a certain amount of money that you want going into the Stewardship Act.
It does. So very much like we have a dedicated funding source for the Springs, we have a dedicated source for Everglades restoration. And now this bill states that we will have a dedicated funding source for the Florida Keys Stewardship Act.
What do you see as the biggest challenge? Is it acquiring more land to protect? Is it, you know, it, because you're also dealing with, rising seas and more flooding. What do you see as the biggest need for that money?
Yeah, and I think all of the above, right? So the Florida Keys are ground zero for sea level rise and all things regarding climate change and the changing oceans and, you know, flooding and all of that. And I don't really perceive the argument as being a challenge. I perceive procedurally there being an issue. Legislatures don't typically like to tie the hands of future legislatures. And so it will be incumbent upon Representative Mooney and Senator Ana Maria Rodriguez to really make that argument. You know, the Everglades are a gem for our state, for our nation, for the planet. Well, you know what? So are the Florida Keys. I mean, there's not a more diverse ecosystem, if you ask me, and I know I'm a little biased, but, you know, in our state. And so adding it to those list of very, very important preservation and conservation programs, I think, is very befitting of the Florida Keys.
So. You had the experience of being up in Tallahassee. And so I wondered, I mean, you to say, yes, the Florida Keys are extremely important. And you look at Monroe County, not a highly populated county compared to the rest of South Florida. But did you ever get pushback from lawmakers to say, hey, that's too much money for an area with such few people?
Yes. And every now and then I would get, raised eyebrow and a question, and I was always happy and willing to answer that and make that argument. But if you look at our size compared to the resources in terms of bed tax, property taxes, it is disproportionately higher than other rural communities and other tourist-based economies. And so I am full speed ahead, have made that argument in the past and willing and able to keep making that request.
Was it a hard sell though? I mean, it's easy to say, look, we got to protect the Everglades. That's a given. But was it ever a hard sell to say, but the ecosystem of the Keys is just as important? It's not just a tourist attraction. It's important for the state. Was that difficult?
Well, and you hit the nail on the head. I mean, yes, it's actually, it's the tail end of the Everglades. Everything that happens up there sort of filters all the way down here. And we are also, and this is getting into the weeds a little bit, an area of critical state concern. That's a designation that comes down from the state, that the state is recognizing that we are environmentally sensitive. If we don't curtail our growth and our development, we're going to have some serious problems. And the state recognized that and designated us. And actually, the city of Key West is its own area of critical state concern. And so through that that designation, we are able to pass things such as the Florida Keys Stewardship Act and make those big asks.
I'm speaking with Monroe County Commissioner and former state representative Holly Rashine about switching from state politics to local and why she wants more money guaranteed for preserving the Keys. It's a delicate ecosystem, yes, but it's a popular place to build. And developers look at it and see opportunity. You know, how do you put a stopper on growth in a place like the Keys?
We are under what is called a rate of growth ordinance. We actually have to ask for permission each year for a certain amount of units that we are able to build. And we will reach build out in the coming years. Some people say it'll be in the next 3 years. Some people think it'll be a little longer than that. But our growth is tied to safe hurricane evacuation. So we have to be able to evacuate all full-time residents in 24 hours. And so once we reach that threshold, if you will, no more building in the Keys. Now, somebody could buy a lot with, say, maybe a mobile home on it or an older dilapidated house, tear that down and build something stronger, flood-proof, concrete, so on and so forth. But once we reach that build-out point, there will be no new units in the Keys. So that's how we handle that.
I hope you're right. But at the same time, I mean, you know, we have a border here in South Florida. Don't build past this because you're going into the Everglades and we keep pushing that border. But
well, and that's something that I feel strongly about. You know, you can only push it so much and then it's going to ruin that beautiful natural resource. So I am not a huge fan and I'm not afraid to say of pushing that boundary. And I understand property rights. I absolutely understand property rights, but there's also, you know, the rights of residents and visitors alike to be able to still enjoy that and not have that encroachment issue.
Do you think SB 602, chance of passing?
I do. I think it's very, very high. The new senator and the new state representative, they have hit the ground running. I know that they've got a lot of team members from, you know, a lot of the different environmental lobbyist groups. I know the realtors are a big fan. They've got a lot of firepower backing them up. And I think there is a real chance. But I know, you know, it takes a couple years to pass things.
Didn't the governor veto this back in 2020?
Well, yeah, that's a whole nother topic, but he did. And in his defense, even though it was my number one priority and something I fought so, so hard for, he saw COVID coming and looming in the background. And he saw that big ticket price tag and was like, well, there's an easy, you know, $10 million. It crushed me. It broke my heart. But I understood he had some really, really big decisions to make.
We're still in a pandemic, though.
I know. So we'll see.
You know, coming up on the Monroe County Commission meeting agenda is another big issue you want to tackle, iguana mitigation. And you want to inquire about the possibilities of iguana extermination. Is that it?
You know, this comes up all the time. People are like, oh, my gosh, there's, you know, iguanas smashed across the highway. My son, my 9-year-old, he's like, Mom, what are you going to do about these iguanas now? And so I thought, you know, let's have that discussion. They have python derbies. They have lionfish derbies. I mean, what can be done? And obviously in a very, very humane way. I'm not, you know, I'm an animal lover, but these things have taken over down here. I don't even know if we're going to be able to move the needle at all. But I thought, you know, my very first agenda item would be something maybe out of the norm, but very, very important. And, you know, they spread disease and they are a mess. They wreak havoc. I'm looking out the window right now at my office and there's some dinosaurs out there. They're not really afraid of people. And, you know, I want to see what our options are.
Right, I'm waiting to see how that plays out. you were appointed as a policy leader recently on a committee, the Presidential Select Committee on Preemption and on the Water and Environmental Sustainability. This is a committee that studies the issue of the state government preempting local home rule authority and looks for solutions to preemption. Why do you want to do this?
Because it was a topic that we constantly tackled up in Tallahassee. And I think that the Florida Association of Counties really wants to look towards or look at appointing former legislators and, you know, sort of bringing their perspective to the table. You know, why does the state always want to preempt local governments? Why do you make those moves? And, you know, and I'm a huge fan of local government. I think there's a reason why we have local governments and they're closest to the people. And so just kind of looking at what are options, you know, educating my former colleagues. So I haven't sat through a meeting yet. I'm really, really excited to see what it's all about.
You know, just full disclosure, you know, WLRN has a podcast. It's called Tallahassee Takeover. And, you know, we explore the different issues when it comes to the preemption in Florida, topics like controlling cruise ships in Key West, the gun control measures, masks, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Do you think your experience in Tallahassee can help local government in this issue, stop preemption?
Yeah, I think it will, and I hope it will. You know, obviously, I'm not sure what I exactly bring to the table, but I'm excited to at least have that discussion. And quite frankly, as a public policy fan, wonk, if you will, I think there's some things that are better left to the state. There are some things that are better left to the locals. So I'm excited to learn about this committee and, you know, bring whatever I can to the table.
Again, that is Monroe County Commissioner Holly Rashan. She's serving out the rest of the late Mike Forster's post on the commission until November of next year. And by the way, a correction, because I had mentioned earlier that Forster had died earlier or died last year. He actually died earlier this year of complications from COVID-19. And I do apologize for that mistake. Well, don't forget that coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to hear from our interview with the astrophysicist and author Neil deGrasse Tyson. But first, the Miami Book Fair is coming back. We're going to talk with organizers about what to expect at the street fair this year. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Miami Book Fair is back. After more than a year of virtual-only programs, the streets of downtown Miami will once again be filled with curious readers and shelves and shelves and tables of books. This year will be a hybrid of in-person and streamed events. The street fair starts next week. That's Friday, November 19th. It goes through the weekend. Streaming events start this Sunday, November 14th. Joining us now to talk about this year's events at the Miami Book Fair, co-founder and the man behind Books and Books, Mitchell Kaplan. Mitchell, it's been a long time.
Hey, Lewis, how are you?
Great.
Thanks so much for doing this once again. It's so exciting that we've got the physical fair back with us.
Oh, absolutely. And also, I got to bring in the fair's director of programs, Lisette Mendez. Lisette, great to have you back as well.
Oh, thanks so much, Lewis. You know how much I love your show.
Oh, well, that's always great to hear that. Thank you so much. You know what? I want to ask both of you, what are you looking forward to most for this year's event? Again, not completely back to normal, but almost back to pre-pandemic days. Mitchell, what are you most excited about?
Well, it's always a tough question. I am most excited about the fact that we're going to have that Big Ten open again, and that we're going to be able to see people coming down and enjoying the street fair and mingling among, obviously with masks and everything, but being among other book lovers and seeing Miami-Dade College, the downtown campus, the Wolfson campus, come alive, all due to a love of literature. You know, there are a million authors that I love. It'd be really hard for me just to choose one, but the one that, you know, that sticks out immediately is the one that we're starting with, and that's Amor Towles. Amor Towles is just spectacular, and his Lincoln Highway, I both read it and I listened to it, and it really doesn't disappoint. It's really wonderful. Yeah. And he'll actually be there live and in person as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Lisette, what about you? What are you most excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of what Mitchell said. For me, the book fair has always been, you know, this event where everyone comes together in Miami. You know, we people who come out for the books, you know, we start with the evenings with programs only a couple of days from now, this Sunday, the 14th. And so, you know, you first start seeing, you know, the people coming in Monday, Tuesday, you know, those are like hardcore readers. They're there for a very specific author. And, you know, you can kind of feel that the curiosity and the wanting to, you know, to get close to those authors, ask the questions. I love the people who stand at the back of the room and they ask the questions. I miss those people, even the ones that are very long-winded. And then I really just, when I walk in on the first day of street fair, I love to see all the people that come that are not necessarily just coming for the authors, but because the kids, you know, we have children's alleys back with activities for children. We have our music stage, the porch, all weekend long next weekend as well. But yeah, I mean, you know, Miami Book Fair brings everyone together. It's been that way since I was a teenager and coming to Book Fair. And, you know, I really look forward to being that place again where everyone feels welcome.
Yeah.
No, you know, Lewis.
Yeah, go ahead, Mitch.
So I just have to give props to Lisette and her team at the college, who have navigated these last two very, very difficult years, but really wonderfully. I mean, if you remember last year, we pivoted very quickly to an online book fair. And this year, because we're not out of the woods yet, we're having a hybrid fair. So we have about a third of the normal amount of authors on campus that we normally do, but the other two thirds are online. And the online experience allows us to do things which we might not have been able to do live and in person. For instance, I mean, imagine Salman Rushdie speaking to Carl Hiaasen, right?
Yeah.
That should be. And that's an online experience you can have. And that lives up in the internet. But then you have the little bit of best of both worlds. So then you can come and listen to these two wonderful writers on Friday night, Dishaw Filiaw and Dantil Moniz, two Jacksonvillian writers, if that's the right way to say it.
I was curious, because, okay, this is, again, now coming into the second year of the pandemic. And so little by little, we're seeing, when you talk about events, we're starting to open up back again. But do you think that we'll ever get back to what it was before? Or do you think that this is just part of the evolution now that you're going to have more online kind of events going into the future, into the, upcoming years?
Well, I think the online experience will always be there now, because we're also having live events, in-person events that will be live streamed out to audiences that are beyond Miami, or if you can't come downtown, you can see it on a live stream. But I think there's, I'm finding authors are hungering to meet their audiences and their readership.
Absolutely.
So I don't think we're going to lose the in-person experience. We just may gain the online experience.
Right.
Lisette, do you feel the same way?
Well, but also Lisette, you said something earlier about, Mitchell, you said it, but Lisette, what about the COVID protocols? What's in place? What should people know going into this event?
Yeah. So, we're asking everyone to wear their masks. The numbers in Miami-Dade County are very low. I think the mayor announced maybe less than 20% in the past couple of days. So, we're asking people to wear their masks. Most of the book fair, at least the street fair portion is outside for those who, feel more comfortable in outside settings. There's definitely a lot to do in the outside areas of the fair. But of course, the fair is all about the authors, and their speaking and their presentations from their books. So we are limiting capacity in the different venues to not be as crowded as we usually are. That's why we're trying to get folks to purchase their tickets, reserve their free tickets ahead of time to make sure that we can manage how many people are coming to the event. And we're asking everyone to wear their masks. I think we should be fine with the level of vaccinations that we have in our county. I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah. And Lisette, as in the past, we always try to make sure that, the fair was always accessible to everybody, especially, with folks in underserved communities. But again, because of some of these challenges that we're still facing, how do you overcome that to make sure everybody has that opportunity?
You mean to come to the fair and be part of the fair?
Yeah.
We work with all kinds of community organizations to provide access for people to come. We work with the Children's Trust, for example, to distribute free passes for families who might be part of Children's Trust programming. And along those lines, we work with downtown residents, people who are in the area, and we offer some, free entrances for them as well. And the fact is that all that we have to offer, for the entrance fee that we have, children are free. Older folks, seniors are $5. So I think there's plenty to offer for the entrance fee that we do charge. But again, you know, anyone who's working with a local agency or who is part of a local agency should check in with that agency that they're with. And chances are we're already working with them, or they can just send me an email, and we can always help out in that way. But yeah, that's always been a big deal for us, being able to keep it affordable, but still be able to keep it. You know, there's a little bit of that balance there between. So we do a lot of fundraising, through foundations. The county has been, is a supporter. The state of Florida is a supporter, individuals, membership. We do a lot of fundraising through our friends at the Miami Book Fair program. These are folks who really believe in what we do and what Miami Book Fair stands for, and they're willing to pay a membership fee so that we can continue
keeping it going as always. Again, talking with Lisette Mendez, the director of programs for the Miami Book Fair, and also the co-founder of the Book Fair. And the man behind Books and Books, Mitchell Kaplan. And as you've been hearing, the fair's not back exactly as it was before the pandemic, but we got the street fair back out there, the tents open. So a lot of opportunity to get back out and walk around and also to meet some of the authors in person. Also, there will be some online events as well. And you can find out about all of it, the whole schedule, everything on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, Mitchell, I was thinking about the fair a lot of times is shaped by what's going on, in the world. And I think about the last year and a half. Oh, we've had the pandemic. We had an election. We had social justice protests. It's been a busy 2 years. And I wondered how that's kind of maybe shaped the fair this year and some of the stuff that people could expect.
Yeah, we decided to take a break from all that. And we're only going to do beach reading at the fair this year. It's going to be only authors who provided books for escape. And I'm just kidding, Lewis.
It might
be a really good thing, right?
I was waiting. I was waiting for the bada bum. There you go.
The fair, the beautiful thing is that the literary world really does reflect what goes on in the world. So you can't have a book fair without reflecting what goes on in the world. So almost every single program, I shouldn't say every single program, but, the new books that have come out, writers' experiences during the pandemic, all of this will be discussed, at the fair. Writers write their work through the prism of what's gone on. There are some, we always have current affairs books that are there. We have biographies. We have a lot of history coming up at the fair. And a lot of these kind of, really interesting pairings speak to all of that. So you're absolutely right. I mean, the fair always reflects what goes on in the real world.
Right.
And what I was also going to say, based on what you were saying before, which about how we serve our community, the beautiful thing is that the fair and the access to the fair, and the fact that we have programs in Spanish, we have programs in Creole, we try to represent the entire community, which is exactly in line with the mission of Miami-Dade College. And kind of the beautiful thing that not everybody knows, but almost everybody knows, is that the college, there's a new president of the college.
Yep.
Her name is Madeline Pumariega. And Madeline was an integral part in the fair for many, many, many years. So this continuity is something that is going to serve the fair really, really well. And so the mission of Miami-Dade College is completely aligned with the mission of the fair, and that's all about access to the people in this community.
Yeah. Lisette, is there any particular event linked to, everything that we've been seeing over these last couple of years that you're interested in and you're anticipating?
Are we talking about what we've been seeing in terms of COVID?
Politics? Everything that we have seen over the last couple of years, because it's been intense.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot of all of it. In the online program, in terms of COVID, we have Eli Saslow and Lawrence Wright, two wonderful journalists who have both written books about going through it, you know, what's been happening when it comes to COVID-19, and they're part of our online program, so easily accessible next week on a schedule that we, you know, people can find it right on miamibookfaironline.com. And they're in conversation with an author, Sherry Fink, who is also a medical doctor and wrote a book some time back about Katrina and being in the hospital during that time as a physician. So that's definitely a book that's tackling COVID-19 and what's been happening. And then we definitely have a number of programs that are about race and race relations, both online and in person, and of course that's been a big topic too with protests. I particularly, one of the writers, because there's a few, Jill Louise Busby, who's writing whose book of nonfiction is titled "Unfollow Me: Essays on Complicity," and it has a lot to do with what she sees as maybe the hypocrisy of organizations that bring on, you know, diversity, people in the diversity world to give lessons or whatnot. Those are just two.
Yeah, no, and listen, just we're going to post up with the list of the schedule, because even though, again, it's a little bit cut back from past years, some of it's online, some of it's out there, you know, that you could go back out there and experience it. The street fair is back to an extent. By the way, I didn't mention the thing I'm excited about is the food. I'm looking forward to that. So
looking forward to the Arepas?
But yes, the Arepas and, of course, the authors. But I just got to say, you know, it's exciting to have the fair back, at least, at this level, because, you know, and the weather hopefully will be wonderful, because that is part of the experience. So thank you so much, both of you, for sharing with us and reminding us of what's out there. And excited to see you both out there as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, Louis, we look forward to it. And also I have to thank you and WLRN for all the support that you guys give. It's really, it's so crucial. So thank you.
Always,
thank you so much, Louis.
Yeah. Always love to be a part of it. Again, Lisette Mendez, the Miami Book Fair Director of Programs, and Mitchell Kaplan, the fair's co-founder and also the man behind Books and Books. Get all the information about the book fair. It's on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, still to come. Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson has some thoughts on what your kids should be learning in science class. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. What are we teaching our kids in science class? Do you know what's on the public school curriculum? You know that U.S. kids are ranked 18th in the world in science. That's according to the Program for International Student Assessment. And we're even worse in math. Why is that? And what could we do about it? Because there are consequences, especially around the denial of science around vaccines and climate change. Well, we recently spoke with astrophysicist and author Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson about those issues. He's going to be at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts on Tuesday, the 16th. We started our conversation asking him about science denial and if it's getting worse.
I think there's always been science denial out there. But those people sort of lived isolated lives. And in the era of social media, they can find each other. And this gives sort of affirmation to what they think is true because somebody else thinks it's true. And as a result, that you can become emboldened and you get a little louder. But I don't know if the total numbers are different, because I can think back at a time when people, I mean, go back, you know, I mean, okay, you can read about this. You go back 100 years or so. Spirit medium readings were very common. And you'd go into a darkened room and someone would come out with a candle or some other spooky light and talk to the dead. This was a big business back then. And there were people, some who had tried to debunk it. But in every era, there are sort of anti-science, pseudoscience fads, let's say. What may be different this time is the science denial has existential consequences, okay? I mean, yeah. You know, if you're not going to take the vaccine and you end up dying because you didn't trust it, that is a consequence. But whereas if you think feathers, you know, feather energy improves your day, you know, that's kind of harmless, right? And no one's going to take that from you. But not only is there the vaccine issue, but anyone who stands in denial that humans are warming the earth and we need to do something about it. These are postures that involve the rejection of some or all of mainstream science. And if you rise to a position of power and you think and feel this way, that's dangerous. And that's the beginning of the unraveling of an informed democracy.
You know, I think about, I mean, you have world leaders right now talking about the climate crisis, and, you know, the last UN report comes out and still people saying no, it's or now the argument is, well, the earth's always been warming and cooling, so that's just natural. And then of course with COVID, you know, I've read stories of people on their deathbed still denying it. I wonder, you know, when a person has reached that place in their mind, are they locked in? Is it impossible to ever reach them?
Yeah, I as an educator, I don't want to believe that. Okay. I want to believe that people can continue to learn. But here's what happens. You go to school and then you graduate and then you're certified with a diploma. Some percentage of graduates think to themselves, I am now educated and now I can go off into the world. And they're thinking that somehow they don't have to keep learning. And so what education should be, formal education should be thought of, I think, is a way to learn how to learn, a way to learn how to retain your curiosity for the unknown. And if that's what education becomes, then you can spend your life continuing to learn and growing in enlightenment and in wisdom. So that changes your outlook, so especially when new things come down the pipe. You might have learned something in school and now we know better than that. And so you don't say, oh, you see, scientists don't know anything. They told me this, but now they told me that. So I won't believe anything they say. See, that's not understanding how science works and why it works. And so many of these same people will simultaneously speak to their friends on a smartphone that uses 1,000 science and engineering technologies to enable them to communicate with other people with whom they're in denial about science. That's the irony of it all.
You know, and I was reading an interview you did recently, and you were talking about that, you know, when a scientist says we don't have the answer or they've changed an answer, people get frustrated. What is it we get wrong about science?
A very important question. So I wrote a brief essay on this. It was titled, What Science Is and How and Why It Works. So anyone wants to Google that, I'd be delighted if you spent a few minutes checking it out. I spent a lot of sort of emotional, intellectual energy composing that. It's only about 600 words. So science is on the frontier. We are doing research in labs or wherever, and we get a result. And if it's an interesting result, we'll publish it. The press, if that published result flies in the face of a previous understanding or is particularly unusual, they'll jump on it and they'll say, latest research shows that blah, 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 blah. And everyone reads that and they think that's the truth. No. That's not how science works. The way science works is somebody gets an idea and they publish it. And we say, I'm skeptical of that idea. I'm going to see if I can verify it. Well, I can't verify it. Someone else says, no, I think it's probably something to it. I'll try to verify it. They can't verify it. Nobody can verify it. You throw it away. Yet you don't remember that because there's a whole newspaper article on that result when it came out. So let's look at it the other way. So now someone publishes a result. It's a little odd or unusual or counterintuitive. And I say, you know, I don't really believe that. Let me try to duplicate that. And I perform the experiment. I'm getting the same result. And somebody else skeptical goes, yeah, they kind of get the same result too. Oh my gosh. And if this repeats, we have a new emergent objective truth in this world. So the problem comes about when everybody wants to eavesdrop on every latest scientific result. And now with COVID, we kind of had to do that because you don't want any more people dying than ought to, than should be. So early recommendations were, we know how many viruses are transmitted through fluids, so let's clean surfaces. Well, how about breathing? Well, we don't know that yet, but we know about fluids, okay? And then we find out COVID transmits heavily by aerosols in your exhaled breath. So now we recommend the mask because it's new things we just learned about it. You don't say, you didn't tell us before, so I'm not going to believe anything. That's not understanding the moving frontier of how science works. And so I don't even want to blame the people who feel this way. I want to, as an educator, I want to take the blame for what we do in schools, because we teach science as a satchel of facts, not as a method of inquiry. And no one knows what's going on the frontier. People think scientists just love agreeing with each other. And you know they think that because newspaper articles say scientists will have to go back to the drawing board because their cherished theories might be upset by this new result. What? Where'd you get that from? We're always at the drawing board. And if you have an idea that disrupts something that we've already been doing, great. We love it. And if you've ever been to a science conference, everybody's arguing with each other. That's the whole point. On the frontier, they're contested ideas until they are verified by multiple experiments in multiple places, and then we move on.
We're talking with astrophysicist and author Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's going to be speaking at the Broward Center on Tuesday, November 16th, and you can find out more information about that on our social media at WLRN Sundial.
You know what? Thank you for bringing up education. This is so fascinating to me. We were having this discussion actually on the program recently about history and what's being taught in history. And of course, the big debate here right now in Florida, like in other places, is critical race theory. But it got me thinking, what are we teaching in science? And if you could put a curriculum together for K through 12, what would it look like?
Man, you give me some good questions here. So I actually think about this often. And one of the problems, I don't want to call it a problem. Science is taught, here's a book, learn it. There are keywords in the back. You'll get a vocabulary test on it. And you do it, and then you're done, and you move on. Okay? And if science were taught differently, if science were taught, here's some things we didn't know anything about, and here's some questions we asked, and here's how long we had to scratch our head, and here's some pathways that ended up wrong, but they ended up wrong for really good reasons. You know, we really thought this was the way it was going to play out, but it didn't. If science were just more of a process, so taught as an activity, as a journey, rather than as a destination, I think our attitudes towards it would just be completely different coming out the other side. And for me, the most important thing is to preserve that curiosity that is so deeply embedded within us all as children. You know, I've said this before, we spend, you know, the first couple of years teaching kids to walk and talk, and then the rest of their lives, you tell them to shut up and sit down. What good is that, all right? You want curiosity to never go away. And what is an adult scientist but a kid who really just never grew up? So maybe I'd leave some things out in the curriculum that you're putting in just to be complete, but they're kind of boring and people don't really need to know it anyway, and they're going to forget it a week after the final exam, all right? and when I write my books, my best-selling book was Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. It's a short book, and this came out a few years ago, and I wrote that. What I did? I cherry-picked the coolest stuff in the universe, and I put it in there because you know it'll happen. You'll read it, and if you like it, you'll go get bigger books on it, and because your curiosity will be stimulated, titillated. And I think everybody has a sort of soft geek underbelly, even if they don't admit it on first round. You say, yeah, I always did wonder how the sun worked, or why is the sky blue? Or, yeah, I always did wonder about rainbows and how do they work? And so if you communicate the science that's really fun and that gets you excited, then you will use your own intellectual curiosity to fill in all those gaps. And if you're trained how to do that, and because you'll spend so much more of your life not in school than in school. By the way, I don't even remember what I learned in school because I learned so much more since I graduated that it's now only a tiny fraction of all that I know and all that I think.
First of all, the fact that Neil deGrasse Tyson just said that makes me feel better about myself and everything I have forgotten in school too. So thank you for that.
No way. Don't use it to justify forgetting stuff. Don't invoke my name.
You know what? We've seen billionaires now really kind of take over the space race. Bezos, Branson, and Musk. Is that a good thing, or should we be putting more into a space program?
Yeah, I'm not going to value judge people's ambitions. All right. I mean, think of what these billionaires could otherwise be doing. They could be, you know, having a yacht contest. Okay. Who has the biggest yacht? So if the billionaires want to go into space and in so doing advance a technological and engineering frontier, I'm all for it. I don't have a problem with that. But I want to temper what you're saying. In fact, I'll be speaking on this in Orlando, where the space, our past, present, and future in space is continually misunderstood by people who have dreams about what the future can or should be. Continually misunderstood. No, the billionaires are not leading our exploration of space. That is not what's happening here, all right? The countries are doing that. Why? What is the exploration of space? Landing on an asteroid, exploring Pluto, orbiting Saturn, all right? Putting rovers on Mars. That is not private enterprise. You know why? Because they can't earn money doing it, all right? Mm-hmm. So what do they earn money doing? Things that we've already done, but now they can do it maybe cheaper, like going into low Earth orbit. Here's everybody really excited about the Bezos Branson suborbital flights, duplicating what Alan Shepard did in 1961. Yeah. And it's, oh, they're leading the space race. No, they're not. They're picking up on a space race that was forged in the Cold War and trying to do it, and trying to democratize it. Great. Let's do that. But to think of it as leading the space, no. But you know what they are leading, especially Elon? They're leading the effort to make access to space cheaper. So they're reusing the part. We never reused parts before. They're reusing it. And it's fun to watch the boosters come back and stick the landing on the bullseye that had just helped launch something into orbit or into suborbital, wherever they're headed. That's always good fun to watch. And we get to reuse that. So, and we there were the beginnings of that with the space shuttle era. We reused the space shuttle. We reused the solid rocket boosters. But the duty cycle on it, that is the times you would, how many times you'd use it in a year, never really amortized out how expensive that was. So this is progress, and I have no problems with it. And I look forward to the day where space as a tourist destination becomes something that we all participate in.
You know, I mean, William Shatner went up into space recently, and I'm you know, to finish up the interview, I'm just curious if any of those guys called you up and said, hey, want to take you up into space? Would you go? Would you go to the moon? Would you go to Mars?
So I'm an astrophysicist. So going into suborbit and falling back to Earth is not my idea of space. All right. And if you want to visualize this, imagine a schoolroom globe and ask, how high up did William Shatner go? And Branson, Bezos folks. How high up did they go if you're holding a schoolroom globe in your hand? They went up the thickness of two dimes above that surface.
Wow, okay.
And meanwhile, you're having people think, oh, I want to see land masses with no national borders. Well, you see that from an airplane, thank you, okay? I want to see the night sky. Well, I can wait till sunset, thank you, and I can see the night sky, all right? I want to see the pale blue dot. You're not seeing the pale blue dot from two dime thicknesses above the surface. Elon did a little better because he actually went into orbit and they went into a high orbit. So he went about a centimeter above Earth's surface. I'm an astrophysicist. You want to send me into space? Send me to the moon, Mars, and beyond. So I have a pretty high bar if I'm going to do it. And if it's going to be on one of Elon's rockets, I say, Elon, have you sent your mother on this rocket yet and brought her back alive? Then I'll go on the ship. So I'm not one of these, let me risk everything just for this one. No, I'm not that guy. I'll be the 100th person to do that, not the first.
That was Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist and author of books like Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. He's hosting his event, The Cosmic Perspective, at the Broward Center for Performing Arts Tuesday, the 16th, and you can find out more about that on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I learned a lot just from that conversation. That's our program for this Wednesday, November 10th. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Amber Amortegui is helping out with production. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And don't forget, the theme music for the program is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at gobalo.com. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, a Veterans Day special. We're going to look back on some of our best conversations with local veterans. Former U.S. Marine Justin Egan served two deployments in Afghanistan. He's now living in Palm Beach County, and he's published several poetry books. And he's going to share his reflections on the U.S.'s exit from Afghanistan. Plus, greyhound racing came to a halt in Florida at the beginning of the year. Some of those retired dogs are getting a chance at a second career. A nonprofit in Boynton Beach is retraining them and pairing them with veterans who need a service dog. All of that coming up on the program tomorrow. Don't forget, we're a podcast as well. Find us on your podcast app, WLRN Sundial. And if you want to go back to any of our old shows as well, you can go to WLRN.org/sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. As always, stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.